82
generation. I'm sure you were worried.
The faith community.
Is it on?
Thanks.
Paul Keeson.
Yep.
The Senate Education Committee for April 11th is in order, and we do have a quorum. I'm going to have Senator Nelson go first. We haven't seen Senator Nino, and Senator Nino and Senator Wieger have some similar bills that we're going to kind of consider in juxtaposition. So, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Olson and committee. Thank you for allowing me to bring before you Senate File 1073. And I know you have a lot of information in your packets today, so I want to make sure you have a chance just to get that information. And the other piece you might want is this excellent brochure, All Hands on Deck. This was sent to me early in the session. I read it and asked for another copy. It's a fabulous list of recommendations for improving our workforce, which we know is very tied to education. Senate File 1073 is an initiative to help students navigate the challenges and opportunities that they encounter on their way to career and post-secondary success. America is slowly coming out of the Great Recession, and only to find itself on a collision course with the future. Not enough Americans are completing college. The Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce shows that by 2018, we will need 22 million new college degrees. But we will fall far short of that number by at least 3 million post-secondary degrees, associate degrees, or better. In addition, we will need at least 4.7 million new workers with post-secondary certificates. We know that post-secondary education provides access to occupations across the economy, while workers with high school diplomas or less are left with about three sectors of the economy. And those sectors are either declining or they have low wages. Nationally, by 2018, 63% of the jobs will require a post-secondary education. And in Minnesota, 70% of our jobs by 2018, not that far away, will require post-secondary education. The shift to a college economy or a credential will continue over the next decade. Senate File 1073 strongly encourages that all students no later than ninth grade should have a career and post-secondary plan. You might see the initial CPP or hear of that. And it helps them prepare for success in a range of post-secondary education and career opportunities. Senate File 1073 is recommendation number 11 from the Governor's Workforce Development Council for strengthening Minnesota's workforce. You will find it in this policy booklet. With me today, I have Brian Lindsay, the Executive Director of the GWCD. I also have Nick Marins, Policy Director. Mai Chi Vang is a student at Harding High School. And Ralph Alexander is the director of College and Career Center, the director for the College and Career Center at Harding High School. And with that, Madam Chair, if I could turn it over to Mr. Lindsley.
So if you'd introduce yourself for the record, Mr. Lindsley, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Lindsley. I'm the executive director of the Governor's Workforce Development Council. We are a council that basically exists to advise the governor and legislature on workforce issues, and thank you for having us here today. We are here to testify in favor of Senate File 1073, and the reason Senator Nelson talked about is because it is in our policy advisory, one of 16 major policy recommendations that the council made at the end of last year for this legislative session, and it's on page 30 of the book that is the nice color book in front of you that explains that recommendation, and we have many others that I do encourage you to look at. Broadly, this recommendation and all of the others in that book really do tackle what we call the skills gap. As Senator Nelson mentioned, in just 7 years in Minnesota, 70% of jobs will require some sort of post-secondary education. So that could be college, certificates, some sort of credential beyond high school. And right now in Minnesota, our rate is about 40% of people who have some sort of post-secondary degree. And we also see that gap widening. As time goes by, globalization and other things are pushing the skill requirements higher. And as the baby boomers retire, a very educated segment of the population, our average skills of workers is going down. And so this recommendation, we believe, does tackle some of that issue. We don't think any one policy will really be able to close the skills gap, but we think this is a positive step in the right direction. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Nick Marins, our policy analyst, who helped our committee of many education stakeholders develop the recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. If you could hand him the mic.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the members of the committee, for having us here today to testify on behalf of Senate File 1073. It's our pleasure.
Your name?
As Brian mentioned...
Your name for the record.
My name is Nick Marins. I'm the senior policy analyst for the Governor's Workforce Development Council. As Brian mentioned, this bill is very similar in nature to a recommendation that the Governor's Workforce Development Council approved unanimously last year. It enjoyed a broad base of support when we were developing it among our committees, the committee that we formed that was made up of business leaders, educators, other educational experts around the state. And we tapped into input for stakeholders all around the state as we developed this. And like I said, it enjoyed a broad base of support. It's also important to note that this recommendation, there are laws similar to this in 21 other states. So this is something that a lot of people have been able to get behind. Why do we need a bill like this? Well, there's a few reasons. As Brian and Senator Nelson both mentioned, we have a skills gap that's growing here in Minnesota. So we know that all students need to graduate prepared for careers and post-secondary education. We also know that many students don't reach that threshold, a lot of people graduating without knowing what their options were or what they could have been doing in high school to get prepared. This bill helps get that preparation process started early. We all know that a goal is important, and in this case, the goal is career and post-secondary readiness. But we all know that oftentimes without a plan set, a goal never gets reached. So we want to make sure, and we think it's a fairly straightforward, cost-effective way to kind of make sure that a goal can be reached by developing a plan for every student to reach those goals. We know that when students aren't ready, when they graduate not ready for career or post-secondary opportunities, that they miss a lot of opportunities, both at the individual level, but also I think as our state also misses out on a lot of opportunities and loses a lot of money. We have studies that estimate that the costs of remediation around the state are at about $90 million annually. So these are costs that are lost. About $50 million of that is lost by colleges and universities having to put resources towards remediation for students coming out of high school. The other $40 million is losses incurred by individuals, students who end up going to school, paying tuition, getting credits that don't actually count towards their degrees and so forth. And we also know that a lot of times when students have to go into college through remediation, that their completion rates are much, much lower. So we think that this bill will help students be better prepared for college, less likely to have to seek remediation when they get to college. So very, very briefly, when we talk about planning in this bill, what are we kind of thinking of? I'll just give a real overview. Generally speaking, in 9th and 10th grade, we're talking about a lot of exploration, working with students to figure out what are their options after high school, what are their interests, what are their aspirations, what are some steps that they need to be taking to get to that point by the time they're graduating. In 11th and 12th grade, usually these kind of systems in schools get a little more specific, talking about actually creating the plan and executing the plan. That can be everything from figuring out what colleges you might apply to or what careers you want to go into, and also actually filling out applications for jobs, for internships, for college, for financial aid, all those things. So it's really a way to kind of make sure that all students are taking these necessary steps so that when they graduate, they're not thinking, well, shucks, what should I have been doing all these years? We think there's a lot of benefits to this kind of planning. A lot of them have been mentioned. We think it helps students navigate and make better decisions. And it helps families kind of identify barriers and as well as opportunities. We think it increases the relevance of education. We know that a lot of times students are wondering, what are we learning in school and how does it really relate to my life after school? Well, this is one way to help tailor education for every student so that they can see the connection between what they're learning in school and what they want to do afterwards. We know that increased engagement and relevance can also lead to better outcomes for students. So we think that this could have a spillover effect that could actually increase outcomes for all students. A lot of the planning models we've seen around the state rely on electronic models for doing the planning that are online and that allow for collaboration between school staff, students, and parents. And we think creating the space for that kind of interaction is also really important in terms of getting everyone on board around this goal of college and career readiness. And we also know that it also generates useful data for schools. So schools can have another way of knowing how their students are doing beyond just test scores and grades and things, but they can actually see, you know, how students are progressing from ninth grade through to 12th grade on all of these kinds of, you know, filling out applications, figuring out what their interests are, looking for scholarships, things of that nature. So it helps schools figure out where needs are within the school and how they can best meet them as well. Importantly, this bill leaves kind of the implementation for these kind of programs up to individual school districts to best figure out how it fits within their own educational programming. But we know that in a number of states, or in a number of areas around the state, this kind of planning is already happening. One particular instance of that is the St. Paul Public Schools. And so we have a couple folks here today from Harding High School in St. Paul who are going to talk a little bit more specifically about their experience with college and career planning at the high school level. So we have with us today Mai Chi Vang, who's a senior at Harding High School, and Ralph Alexander, who's a College and Career Center counselor and director at Harding High School. So with this, I'll turn it over to them. Thank you.
All right, well, I'd just like to thank you guys for letting me come here and allowing me to share my personal story about the College and Career Center at Harding High School. Again, my name is Mai Chi Vang, and I'm a senior. All right, so I moved up here to Minnesota in the summer, so it's before my senior year, and I didn't know anybody. I didn't know any teachers, any counselors, and I had no clue as to what I'm going to be doing for college. I mean, I knew I wanted to go to college, but I just didn't know how to take the steps. And then I met Mr. Alexander, the guy who made up the College and Career Center, and then all right, so what the College and Career Center is, it's a place where kids can go, and then they can get help on their scholarships, applying for colleges and getting help on the financial aid. And then the staff in there, they're really, really, really helpful. Amy Musil, she works in the CCC lab, and then she's been helping me throughout the whole year. Every time I have, like, a scholarship, I'll give my essays to her, and then she'll give them back to me by the end of the day, so which is really, really great, and she's been a big help. Back when I was in Nebraska, we had nothing like this. And then, like, Harding's freshmen, they start off knowing what they want to do, and then, like, they also get to explore other careers, and then, like, at least they have a plan to do, like, to know what to do after college. And then, whereas in Nebraska, when I was a freshman, I had no clue as to what I'm doing. Honestly, I didn't even have college in my mind until, like, probably junior year, and then that's when I started, I guess, thinking about college and what I'm going to do and all this other stuff. And so my friends back down in Nebraska, they would always call me, and they'd be like, oh, my gosh, I need help, like, applying for scholarships, applying to colleges. I don't know what I'm doing. And then I'm telling them, well, I mean, I'm at this new school, and then they have this great program that's helping me finding scholarships and applying to colleges. And then they're just really, I guess, jealous that I get all this great help, and then they really don't have nothing. And then I also have friends and cousins who go to school up here in Minnesota, but then they're at other school districts, so they don't have the CCC. And then, sorry. And then again, they also face the same problems that my friends back Fed back down in Nebraska has as applying for colleges, basically the same thing. And then I'm just like, wow, like, this great program that Harding has is really, really a great thing for me and for all the other Harding kids. And then I've also talked to my Harding friends who has been at Harding ever since freshman year, and they just love it. That they think that it's such a great hope, and then they know what they're doing in life instead of just going right away to work after high school. And then my friend, he even said that without the CCC, he wouldn't be as successful as he is now. So I am the first in my family to go to college, and meaning that I have nobody to help me out, such as applying for colleges and scholarships. And so with that, I turned to the CCC for help because, I mean, that's what they're there for. And I got all the help that I needed, and they helped me a lot on my financial aid, which is a big factor in my family because I do come from a huge family, and we're also not doing so well financially. And so because of the CCC, I know exactly what I'm going to do after college. I'm going to St. Ben's next year, and I'm planning to major in biochemistry. And then, all right, so originally when I moved up here, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to go to a college where everybody goes because, I mean, I don't know any colleges around here. But then after Mr. Alexander gave me a talk about all these other colleges and that there are many, many opportunities for me, I guess I can see that, and I took that route, and yep, so I'm planning on going. And so not only did the CCC help me out academically, but it also helped me build relationships with my teachers, with my classmates, and it made me feel like I was at home because, again, I was new. I knew nobody. And then thanks to the CCC, everything's all good now.
Thank you, Ms. Bain. Are you... You will introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair, fellow members of the committee, thank you for the privilege of speaking today. My name is Ralph Alexander. I'm the director of the College and Career Center at Harding High School. If you're like me...
Welcome, Mr. Alexander.
What's that?
I said, welcome, Mr. Alexander.
Oh, thank you.
I was recognizing you to speak, so go ahead.
If you're like me, I like to hear the results before I invest too much time in listening to someone's ideas. So I'm going to give you a few of our results. In 2005, we set a goal for our students of gaining $500,000 in scholarships, not including financial aid. We exceeded that goal of $500,000. We have increased scholarships each and every year since then, last year reaching $8.9 million. Starting in 2005, we had 100% completion rate of the six-year plan. I find these two factors to be not coincidental. I believe that these are a direct relationship with each other. Back in 2003, with the administration leadership of Kent Pickell, who was in the room at this time, the St. Paul Schools, under the also direction of Dan Labor, developed a software program called, fittingly, the six-year plan. Since Harding has adopted the six-year plan, all of our results have improved. And again, I feel like that's no coincidence. Six-year plan is a guide or a structure to help students be accountable for their future. Six-year plan allows teachers, counselors, and parents to monitor students' progress and is a one-stop shop to leverage our resources and staff that can help our students. The six-year plan has developed at Harding to increase our already high expectations. Generally, how it works is in ninth grade, students start with a six-year plan, and we have a structured curriculum for the students, so each student has to go through that structured curriculum. One of the questions I'll ask a ninth grader is, what are you good at? Almost universally, nothing. Yet, three-quarters of our students speak another language, which is one of the most important skills in the world today. It registers on almost every list that you see of what the most important skills are, having a second language, and three-quarters of our students have that. So in ninth grader, we're trying to help the students explore, build a winning streak, learn about themselves. In 10th grade, it gets to be more of understanding our resources, seeing how they can get help, looking at like income, looking at job trends, doing some research. And then as Nick had mentioned earlier, in 11th and 12th grade, students are doing nuts and bolts. How do you fill applications? How do you do financial aid? We actually get in there, help them, and make sure that they get the job done. In closing, I want to tell you about my day today. First thing that happened this morning is I came in over the weekend this morning and found out that 12 of our students won the Dell scholarship valued at $20,000 per scholarship plus a free laptop and printer. It's always a good day when your students have earned $250,000 by lunch. I came to the Capitol today with my Chi Fang. She is an English language learner. And get this, this is the first time she has ever spoken into a microphone. And today it was at the Minnesota State Capitol. Coincidence? I think not. I came to the Capitol today also to tell you that Mai Chi Vang is a hard worker, and with the guidance of the six-year plan, she is heading to this College of St. Benedict and has already won $100,000 in scholarships. I hope this bill is passed so that every student in Minnesota starts in ninth grade with high expectations and is driven as Mai Chi Vang is to such great success. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander. That's inspiring. Thanks for starting with the results. Are there any questions? Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, that's just astounding what you've done. It's really very impressive. I think those of us parents who have had our children graduate wish that you were at our schools. No, that really is very, very outstanding. And congratulations to you for going to St. Benedict's. My son's at St. John's, and it's an outstanding campus and a wonderful program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. I think this is a wonderful, wonderful proposal, and I so appreciate that you put this together and brought the center to, you know, to make this decision. So I really support this. I have a question about the proposal. The bill talks in line 2.9 about reviewing this plan at least once a year, at least annually, by the student. And I was wondering, Senator Nelson, if you would be open to increase that to at least twice. And the reason I say this is, you know, I have a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old. And there is a sense in the schools that in Minneapolis that they are old enough to make these decisions, and we so much believe in this independency and being responsible. And I feel like I have to remind them of everything every day. And, you know, if we look at this plan only once a year, I'm afraid that we're going to miss an opportunity to do a review in the middle of the year, for instance, to take some classes to really encourage them to review their plans. And if they do it at the end of the year or the beginning of the year, we may lose that opportunity in the middle of the year. And I don't know if there is a reason for only once, but I'm just curious about that.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, there's nothing in the current language that would preclude a semiannual evaluation. Certainly that could happen. Actually, this language was developed by the Governor's Workforce Development Council, probably with all the stakeholders in mind. And so I would not feel comfortable changing that without certainly talking to those stakeholders who have so well vetted this and brought everybody on board.
Well, Senator Nelson, it's
It does say at least annually.
Yes,
I think it plants that seed that isn't something that is. You indicated earlier that you were trying to have something that's got some flexibility and that a lot of the decisions would be made locally as to how that would be implemented. That would be, but I certainly understand yes. Senator Torres Ray's point on this because of the various courses that would be the case. I don't know what, Mr. Alexander, what has been the experience in terms of the review of these plans at Harding?
Honestly, I don't think there's a day that goes by that we don't look at it. There's pie charts for each one of these areas, and that's results. I mean, that's what we live and die on is results, and so we're looking at that really on a constant basis.
I have another question for you, because one thing that's been a little close to my heart, and I think Senator Stumpf shares that with me, is on line 123 and 24 about integrating the academic content in some career-focused courses and vice versa. What does Harding have in terms of program for some career exploration or even developing some of those career skills toward employment at the high school level?
Well, we have academies where there's a career focus in each academy, and they do specific activities. And there's also a comprehensive curriculum where students come in and they go through and explore their own areas of interest, including the career outlook, you know, job trends. We think that's really important. One of the things we often say is you don't want to spend all this time, money, energy, and then get out into a field that's just collapsed, you know, and then how much the students would be making, what's the average students employees would be making at that job. They look at an in-depth study of they can go online and see actual people in that position and what a day in their life is like or what their career like and how they can prepare to become that into that career. So we do a lot of that.
So, and Mr. Alexander, do you have any hands-on type of courses or experiences either through an on-the-job application or within the school in any of these career areas?
Yes,
or
we do. We do.
Areas?
Yep, we do job shadowing. We connect students rigor. We try to keep the students have a rigorous study so that gives them the most options, and then we also can help them specifically take coursework that's connected to the careers that they're interested in. And many, teachers have ability to give them skills and academics toward their specific career.
Thank you. You know, you've heard it, and we've had it in our bill that's going to conference committee now of some opportunity or at least some help for school districts to retain some of their career-focused courses, and I think we've heard from students that need that opportunity to learn in an applied way and try to recognize the fact that many of them gain strong academic skills when they're studying in occupational or vocational areas. I was, when you started to talk about this, all of you, I was reminded on Saturday, I met with a group of people in my area that are concerned about the arts and some of the loss of some of those opportunities within the school system, and the community is kind of stepping in and developing some of these things and trying to forge a plan and where they're going to go. But in the course of that discussion from some of the parents that were there, I was just astounded because they brought up we are losing our career focus, whether even our industrial arts and some of the family and consumer science and these programs, they're going, and not every student is aligned to learning in just a strict academic classroom setting, and they need these kinds of programs. And then the city manager was there and pipes up and said, well, we're losing through retirement many of our public works people. And he said, there's nobody that's coming along that knows how to fix things and make things and do things. We need people that have, you don't think of public works, but they are repairing equipment, they're problem solving, they're doing all of these things day by day. They need to have some strong skills. And she said, nobody's getting that anymore. And I mean, that I thought, wow. I had never heard it even coming from that perspective, and the conversation kind of went an entire different direction. And I think people are starting to wake up and realize that we, either whether we've just totally value the academics. They're important, but I think a lot of people, some of us even, kind of need to see them integrated with other dimensions of life and how they're used in order for that learning to be, strong and lead to success in a career as well. So I just I got to put in a plug whenever I have a chance. Senator Stump, do you agree with me?
Madam Chair, I always agree on this with you on this. In fact, I was just visiting with a group of parents upstairs, and mentioned about that provision in the bill, and saw a whole host of heads nodding. And I think, I think education has to be a very well-rounded package in order to be a good education system. I think I think this component of our education system has been maybe okay in some areas, but we have, I think it's also suffered from a lack of funding. I think it's suffered from skilled educators like yourself and many others across the state. And so I think it's something that we we can all benefit from as we look forward.
Thank you. I appreciate the fact that you've been pretty comprehensive in your bill of covering these various areas and trying, as people are challenged to work through this in their own local plan, that they not overlook any of them, any of these dimensions. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to reiterate first how impressive this report is. And I don't read cover to cover every one that I get, but I read this twice, and we've got to make sure it gathers momentum and not dust. Ms. Vang, your testimony was so inspirational, and we look forward to greater things ahead. I support the voluntary effort. I realize that we're not doing mandates as much, but if it's good enough to encourage, I believe it's good enough to require, especially with the bills that Senator Nienau and I are going to have about, putting further expectation as to what do we mean by college career ready. And this approach kind of makes sure there's a plan early on, and I think it's important. While I'm tempted to say we should expect this of districts, maybe we continue to encourage. But I also realize that if we did that, we probably don't have enough tools. Even with some potential levy in career, we probably need to hire at least 300 or more counselors for the 480 or so secondary schools. This gets at the heart of what counselors do. And you're stretched, and I know you know that, and I'm sure you discussed this in your seminars, your workshops on best practices, but it's got to be a struggle. So I appreciate Senator Nelson, you're coming forward with the proposal, wholeheartedly support it. I resist the temptation to require it or to offer additional resources to back that up. But
thank you, Senator.
That's how it's going to work.
We have challenges throughout the system because we're in an era where there's a lot more competing interests after resources, and we're in a field that has not been able to achieve productivity measures like other areas. And I think you've also talked about the role, because technology can in fact help with that. And in many of the areas that you even talked about, we can't always add people because of the cost. Otherwise, we're going to lose ground rather than gain. And so I appreciate the approach that you've taken. And I don't know if you wish to vote on it. We are going to lay this on the table. There is possibly going to be a policy bill, and I think this would be an appropriate one for inclusion in such a measure. So we want to get on to Senator Nienau's and Senator Wieger's bill as well. But thank you very much for a very effective presentation on a very important subject. So is there... Would you like to move to lay this on the table for possible inclusion in the policy
Madam
bill?
Madam Chair, if I could just make a couple comments
certainly.
And make that motion. Certainly we thought about mandate, Senator Wieger. We just don't feel it's the time for that. Sometimes you can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar. I think what we're saying here is that this is a – hopefully the legislature will give a strong recommendation, strongly encourage this. We have – the need is well documented. We've got great examples of successes sitting right beside us here today. And so my hope is that this will be acted upon favorably. It also helps break down the silos that we have between our education system, so making sure that what we're doing in K-12 is actually translated then into preparing kids for the workforce. So, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate file 1073 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same thing. Thank you for that, and thank you all for your testimony. And Ms. Vang, your first experience in speaking. We're honored to have it be before the Minnesota Senate Education Committee, and I wish you well. I think we all wish you well trying to find the way to spend all that scholarship money. That is wonderful. That is wonderful. Thank you all. Senator Nino and Senator Wieger, if you would both come up and be ready to present your bills. And we do have a side-by-side that Ms. McQuay has prepared for us on these two measures. So we're getting prepared for conference committee style functioning here. And
it is a mandate.
The most fantastic document. I talk
first, or whatever you get in here.
Thank you very much. Oh. Will you be at the box?
Oh, she's coming. Okay. So have you decided who's going to go first over there?
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau.
Senator Wieger.
Asked me to start, and we'll go back and forth a bit.
Okay.
Thank you, members. The proposals before you look at why do we have a high school diploma? What are the expectations that we have? And it gets to the bottom line as to why we are here, I believe. What is the expectation for leaving high school? And in fact, are you college ready? Are you career ready? Everything leading up to that is hopefully going to lead to at least that minimal expectation. To address that, we have a number of common things. You'll note I'm a co-author on Senator Nienau's bill, and by and large, many of the concepts we agree with. For example, college and career ready, and there is a Access Task Force. You're going to hear from Kent Pickell, who co-chaired that in a little bit. We agree that you should be college and career ready. There's some definitional changes that can be sandpapered. We agree there should be an assessment advisory group, a nonpartisan, non-political group, but of experts that provide balanced input as to the assessments that are done in the state. But we also don't take that responsibility and say we're no longer involved. We say there should be legislative approval, and that was done in the past, and we both agree on that. We agree there should be optional pathways in the evaluation. For example, if you do well on an ACT score, or if you have an advanced placement score, or IB, International Baccalaureate, or the CLEP for the college level entrance exam, if you do well in those, should we have another test to demonstrate proficiency? No. And these should be items to help reduce the amount of tests. We agree that for reading and writing, we have two separate tests now. We would bring those into one at the sophomore level. It would be to assess your reading, your writing, your literacy skills. And that's a part of the provisions that we have. There's a difference on math.
And I just wanted to comment a bit on that. You recall a few years ago that we put a hold on the expectation for passing the grad test on math, and the background on that was that we were looking at a projection of nearly half of the students in the state not being proficient. And even after remediation, thousands of students not probably graduating. And I've shared with the veteran members before, I had met with Governor Pawlenty and Commissioner Segrin and some others talking about the concern. And the discussion then was have a hold, but then let's get an end of course, something that will test that Algebra 2, test your proficiency so you get immediate feedback, and to implement an end of course system. And in fact, we have proposed this in the past, and it's again in my bill, Senator Nino's bill, for end of course testing, though there's some differences in terms of the stakes, the high stakes, and there'll be some testimony on that. But overall, I think there's a great deal of agreement, and I think we need to get something done this year. I'm troubled by the continued delay at the federal level on not reauthorizing the No Child Left Behind. Obviously, it needs to be substantially changed, but we hear the comments from both parties that, it's going to get done, it's going to get done. That's been several years. That does not put on hold what we're going to do. We can set what we feel is important for Minnesota students. Not only can we, that's our job. And I commend the commissioner for wanting to reduce the number of tests, and that's part of the 7-point plan and reform that's being addressed. But that doesn't mean we're on hold here in the Senate or in the legislature. We have a proposal, Senator Nino and I, that would reduce testing in part, and we would encourage that type of effort. I guess the only area that we need to further look at is the cost, and that can be further discussed when we look at what the implications are and the priority. But we need to measure what we're doing, or we're not going to have a real good gauge as to whether we truly are preparing students to be college-ready or career-ready. And that ultimately is what our mission is, and in part we use tests. We have some alternative pathways to address that. And Madam Chair, that concludes my introductory remarks, and I'll yield to my colleague, Senator Nino, and my testifier who will be here will be Kent Pickell.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe there's an A1 amendment. Is that in the packets?
Yes.
Was it? Okay. It's not?
It's here.
It's in the attachments.
That's right. It's in the packet that was handed out with my letterhead. So, but we can, or the wording is there. If members want to look at that while the official is handed out. It really is pretty much technical. I'll just speak to that, Madam Chair. There's several locations where we're changing meets or exceeds grade level standards and simply replacing that with is proficient. And there's some notwithstanding language that's added, apparently because it was in conflict with another section of law that prohibited some science tests. Really, that's all that the A1 amendment is, Madam Chair, so I can offer that.
Okay, Senator Nino has offered the A1 amendment. Is on the black, the back page of the John Nino handout, and I think some of you are already getting the legal size paper that is carrying about a 2-inch amendment here. So. And that's an author's amendment, so Senator Nino moves the A1 amendment. Need any further to examine it? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If members of the committee want to refer to a handout that was passed out as we were coming to the table on top of this high school graduation assessments, I'm just going to quickly walk through. This is drafted or drawn up specifically to Senate File 605, my version of the legislation. And it has three parts in here. The very first part with the three bullet points, that's where we're at today. What do we require today to earn a high school diploma? And essentially what we're looking at is you've got to pass the ninth grade writing assessment, the 10th grade reading assessment, and you have to take, but don't have to necessarily pass, the 11th grade math assessment. Now, the bill is proposing some changes. We would move the requirement to pass the 11th grade math assessment up 1 year. That the requirement to pass was delayed, as Senator Wieger said, because nobody was passing. So the state simply said, well, if no one's passing it, we're going to take away the requirement, at least for the time being. This bill would move that closer, a year closer than what is in current law. Beginning with the class of 2017, it replaced the current high school minimum competency assessments with 10th grade combined reading and writing assessment, an end-of-course high school algebra assessment, and an end-of-course high school biology assessment. And that's, I believe, what required that notwithstanding language that was in the author's amendment. And students will be required to pass each of the assessments with a passing score set at a level indicating students are performing, they're proficient, that they're proficient. Now, the last part of this page here talks about some implementation. What would we have to do to get this done? The combined reading and writing assessment, we'd give those at the end of 10th grade, similar to the current reading assessment. Excuse me. The end-of-course assessments in high school algebra and biology would replace the classroom teacher's final exams, and classroom teachers would get end-of-course assessment results in this legislation in 5 days. Senator Wieger's got a little tighter schedule on that. I don't think that really matters so much. It's just a matter of making sure that we get those back in a timely fashion. Students who don't pass an assessment must have access to district-designed remediation for reading and writing, retake the course, et cetera, and retake the assessment. And there's an appeals process for reading and writing so that we understand that there may be extenuating circumstances in some cases, but it does restrict that to 2% of the population so that not everybody gets to appeal, that it's just trying to catch those really unique circumstances. 2% maybe is the right number, maybe it's not, but that's the idea, that there's some level of capitation. And then there's exceptions from the requirement to pass, there's exceptions from the requirement to pass the assessments, and those can be made for special ed students with an IEP, ELL, who are enrolled in school for 4 years or fewer, students transferring from another state who've passed a comparable assessment. So we tried to accommodate all the different angles that, where we might have some catches in the system. Madam Chair, members, that really is just a really quick rundown of what the legislation is, where we're at, what the legislation would do, and kind of how that would be implemented. And I know specifically to this legislation, Mr. Bartholomew would like to have a chance to talk to that a little bit, Madam Chair, however you want to proceed.
Do you have any questions of the authors now, or would you like to hear from the testifiers? I don't know, Senator Nelson, if you beat Senator Stump up with a hand, but I see you both at the same time.
Okay. Well, I certainly look forward to hearing from Mr. Bartholomew, but I have a question that I just can't get my mind around, so just help me get so I can concentrate on the rest of the testimony. Your packet, which is very nice, by the way, says there's no fiscal impact, and yet I read the fiscal note, and it has a $6 million price tag, and I need some clarification about that.
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, that's wrong.
Delete, no.
There is a fiscal impact. There's a fiscal note in the packet, and the fiscal note is correct.
So the fiscal note is $6 million. Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson.
So what would the process be here? We've already passed our budget bill. This has a $6 million price tag. How do we pay for it, or what's the process?
Senator Nelson, we did not change the appropriation in our Senate version for testing and assessment. Do these fiscal notes take into consideration what assumptions do they make? Because I haven't had a chance to review it here in terms of how much funding might be included in our current biennial. Current biennial budget proposal when it ultimately is passed.
Madam Chair and members.
This projects out into the future, obviously, but would this be covered or would it not?
Madam Chair and members, if I get this wrong, I see that Dr. Mattson's in the out there, and he can correct me, but when fiscal notes are prepared, they assume the baseline, and there was $15.15 million in the forecast. It's not a forecasted program, but it was assumed to be continued at the current appropriated levels. My assumption here is that these costs would be over and above that $15 million that we have in the statewide testing budget.
Mr. Madsen is nodding. Do you wish to add to that in terms of helping Senator Nelson be able to focus on the upcoming testimony?
Madam Chair, members, Dirk Madsen with the department. Just
yes.
Nominant is correct. Just a point of clarification. Yes. It does say that dollars less the agency can absorb. Essentially, those are repurposed dollars from the current assessments that we would then turn over into the new. So it is not the net is not the $6 million. The net is, I think, I don't have in front of me, 2.5 or somewhere 5. In the neck of the woods.
Thank you. Okay. So this does accommodate redirecting those based on some policy shifts that are in these proposals.
Madam Chair, that's correct. With the inclusion that it does include roughly a $2.5 million increase over the $15.1 million that's currently allotted.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nino, I'll let you.
Sorry. Madam Chair, I just want to make one comment that a large portion of this bill, maybe all of it, is in the House omnibus bill. So the conferees will be reconciling that in
same position.
So that's something that the conferees will be dealing with.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator Nino. Not having had a chance to study that very carefully, I think it's very appropriate we're having these hearings right now to establish a greater understanding on our part. So thank you for that. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who I should direct this to, but it's more of a comment. Part of the testing process that we have, and I know we had problems with the math testing, is the I'm just reflecting a meeting I had with a fairly large group of teachers that the tests do more than test their knowledge. The testing companies, I believe, are, and Mr. Madsen may can comment on it, are instilling questions into the test that would be used or tested for future tests. And the teachers are suggesting that when you get these tests, maybe there's a calculus or algebraic questions that are way beyond the level of what that test is actually testing or should be testing. And so they see signs of students who are totally overwhelmed when they get these test questions that are not the true measurement of their skill level. And I'm just wondering if some time ago, one of the presentations had talked about a test that as you complete your continue to answer test questions correctly, they continue to get more difficult. And as you are not able to answer those difficult questions, it goes the other way until you actually can start answering those questions. Why can't we use that system, which would be less intimidating for our students than to inject a element of measurement that students can't really achieve?
Madam Chair, Dirk Madsen's going to respond, but for the new members, Dr. Madsen, he's our state's premier psychometrician, and he's the test maker. He puts it all together, so this is the expert.
Dr. Madsen.
Madam Chair and members.
We have high expectations.
Yeah. Obviously. I'm trying to figure out a way to diffuse those as quickly as possible. So I thank you very much, Senator Wieger, but there are folks way smarter than me. A couple of comments. One is that is correct. In typically, and this is not from a testing company, every state in the country does this, they seed in questions, a few questions in that will be used in future tests. And instead of having kids take a second test, they sprinkle those test questions in. It's called in the business, it's called embedded field testing. Those questions are built on the same set of standards. They're going to be used on the same set of standards that the students are currently taking. So they aren't harder questions or easier questions. They're questions similarly aligned to the content that the students are engaged in right now. In order to build a vertical scale, so to be able to show growth on them, a common technique is that some questions are put in from previous grades or from future grades, but they don't count toward the student's score, but they allow us to build the scale. No student sees more than maybe one or two of those questions, and it's only done in the first year so we can build that vertical scale. So that's a whole other piece, but the questions that we do embed in our for field testing are aligned to the state, with minimal exception, are aligned to the state content standards. They do not count toward the student's score when they are being used in that preparatory mode and certainly that vertical scaling mode. I'm pleased to tell you, Senator Stump, that the state is moving to adaptive testing as soon as this coming fall. Students will have the opportunity in mathematics. We are doing this revision as the tests change. So in statute, as you know, the tests are required to change to be aligned to the new set of content standards, and that schedule is laid out both in MS State Statute 120B.30 and also in the state academic standards statutes. So as the tests are revised, we're not going to do this wholesale. We're going to do it in a methodical manner. So as they are revised, starting with grades 3 through 8 mathematics, which for this year are the first time that they're being aligned to the 2007 content standards, we are going to allow students starting next fall to take adaptive tests. They will have the opportunity to take those tests up to 3 times. We aren't asking them to take them 3 times, and the highest score will count toward accountability. So they'll be able to use additional benchmark assessments to be able to get more informative information for teachers along the way. The system is being redesigned, but being done in hopefully a thoughtful and methodical process as we move forward.
Okay. Madam Chair, just one follow-up. Another aspect that a number of teachers brought up is that and these were teachers in districts that were relatively poor, had a number of difficulties with having students having the, and I'm not sure, do they allow a certain type of calculator for graphing questions?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, the calculator, we do allow various types of calculators. They're allowed, but no item on the assessment requires the use of a calculator as far as a certain type that it must be graphing, et cetera. All the items are designed because there isn't in the standard saying that it must be the Texas Instruments Inspire 850, et cetera.
No, Madam Chair, I know that it didn't. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that it didn't. They didn't specify a particular brand. But their concern was that many of the students did not have those tools to take the tests, and consequently were at a disadvantage. And I'm just thinking that, well, yeah, if you go into a district that has all the tools to take the test and preparation, that's quite an advantage over those students that might not be able to either afford it or have had the preparation to use them.
Thank you. Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, you're correct, although I will reiterate that the test is designed in such a way that a calculator is not required to complete any of the items. So there isn't anything that says take the, no matter what company makes the calculator, it doesn't say take the graph that's now present on your calculator, et cetera. All of the functions and operations that a student should be able to do should be able to be done without a calculator. The fact that they are allowed to use those, certainly is specific according to district. We try and we're very specific about it being a four function versus a scientific versus a graphing calculator. The other thing I will say in the online test that I just mentioned, as those items are available, the calculator is available on the screen for the students.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Mattson, don't go. That's why I shouted out earlier, because I want you to stay at the table. I have a couple questions. I know we've been talking about moving towards end-of-course testing for some time. Are we already in development on end-of-course tests, given we didn't pass legislation, or has it been just talk?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, no, we have not developed any end-of-course tests. We have not begun development in any end-of-course tests. We develop the tests that are required in statute. Now, I will say, with that said, we have probably shaded toward developing, at least last year, we were trying to do the Solomon-esque moment here of split the baby in half as far as let's develop our algebra items first, but still not preparing for an algebra exam, waiting until that legislation were to pass. So we have algebra items developed, but now we have to go out and fill out the rest. The statute currently requires a new 11th grade exam operational in the spring of 2014 as a comprehensive assessment in grade 11, and that's what we're building for.
Madam Chair, Dr. Mattson, will you be able to use a I assume many other states use end-of-course tests. Is there a possibility of using someone else's tests so that we save money? And I know that was one of the reasons why I've been a supporter of the Common Core, because although, again, mathematics is perhaps different because we have tougher standards, but is there some economic advantage to trying to work with a pre-developed test?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, certainly there is an economic advantage to sharing the load. This becomes a little more challenging in the sense that Minnesota, most of the states now, as you know, have adopted the Common Core, and so their efforts are going toward development and preparation for assessing the Common Core. We don't have necessarily that luxury. We might be able to come to some item-sharing agreements, but there won't be it'll be challenging to find a state that we could just say, can we have a copy of your test and hand it out, because it will not have that standards alignment that we're required to do both professionally and for the federal government and for state statute as well.
Madam Chair, just a couple more follow-up comments. With regard to where we are on our current test, where we have, virtually kind of just let go, we couldn't come to a conclusion as to how to deal with that. Did we before have an exception allowable for special ed students with IEP? Was that one of the reasons why we couldn't, somehow resolve our concerns around that?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, the IEP allowance has actually been present since the days of the BST, and so I don't think that particular item was a sticking point for the committee. I think there was I hate to speak for the committee, and maybe Mr. Pickell can say so, but I believe there was relative consensus around that. That's a practice that Minnesota's had for quite some time, to allow the IEP team the ability to determine an individual passing score for that student.
And then lastly, Dr. Mattson, do you think that it makes sense, given we're moving to the end-of-course tests, to go back and make the current grad high stakes, in terms of no flexibility? Or is that more a decision for the legislators?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, since you phrase it that way, glad to defer. I will tell you that certainly, since I have the opportunity to speak to that, the commissioner would like to iterate that she does have concerns about changing the rules at this point when the game has been engaged, that the goalposts are going to change a little bit. We've told students what our expectations are. They've signed up for high school courses according to those expectations. They may have made different decisions had they known accountability features would be in place. So not even necessarily specific to the end of course. I think you could almost separate those two issues. I think her concern, certainly on moving the date, would be just that. And then I know that she has concerns over the end-of-course assessments, the variability in teacher performance, having a licensed teacher of record in the classroom, et cetera, and has continued concerns. I'd be glad to make comments about those in appropriate time about the timing of moving to end-of-course right now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mattson. We've got Kent Pickell and Jim Bartholomew here to testify. Would you like to go ahead?
Madam Chair, my name is Kent Pickell. I'm the director of the College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota, and as was noted by a group earlier today, a former educator, actually a graduate of the St. Paul Public Schools.
Great. Welcome.
It's an honor to be with you to speak in support of Senate File 143. The system outlined in this bill is similar to the one that a task force of Minnesota stakeholders developed last spring at the request of the legislature and the previous Commissioner of Education. I co-chaired that task force with Dr. Mattson, and we called the final result the ACCESS system, or ACCESS, which is perhaps the most tortured acronym in state policy history for achieving college and career success. career readiness for every student's success, thereby proving the inadequacy of the acronym. Let me begin my remarks in support of this bill by saying that we have a very demanding set of mathematics requirements in Minnesota, from the rigor of our state standards to requiring all students to take Algebra 1 and 2, one of the first states in the nation to do that. That's good. And please don't interpret anything I say this afternoon as suggesting that we should back off those commitments to help all students master the higher level mathematics that we know is necessary for success in all forms of post-secondary education and high-skill careers. The most essential question before you today is what level of achievement in mathematics, and also language arts and science, should be the minimum requirement for earning a high school diploma in Minnesota today. And that, Madam Chair and members, is a very big question. In fact, I'd argue that among all of the major educational issues you're debating here during the current legislative session, none will have as great or as immediate an impact on literally thousands of students across our state as the one you're considering now. We can see that impact by looking at the 2010 results on our state's 11th grade exit exam in math, otherwise known as the GRAD. 58% of all students in 2010 passed the math GRAD on the first attempt, which means that 42%, Madam Chair and members, did not. 64% of white students in our state met that requirement, but 36% did not. That is roughly one out of every three white students in Minnesota who did not pass the math test on the first attempt. And I highlight that figure because discussions of this policy have often and appropriately focused on the disproportionate impact it would have on students of color. So let's turn to those numbers. 23% of black students in Minnesota met the GRAD requirement in math on the first try in 2010, which means that 77% did not. 29% of Hispanic students met the requirement, which means that 71% did not. 27% of Indian students met the requirement, which means that 73% did not. 54% of Asian students met the requirement, which means that 46% did not. Now, some of those students will meet the requirement by working hard and retaking the test. But please remember, Madam Chair and members, that it's given at the end of 11th grade, and so there's 1 year in which they can do so. Faced with those types of numbers, the legislature and Governor Pawlenty agreed to put in place a reprieve and created the task force that I co-chaired. Some feel that that reprieve was a step back from high expectations and accountability, but I believe it was an unavoidable recognition of educational and political reality. The outcry that would have occurred over the decision not to grant diplomas to the number of students I've just described would have been deafening, and not just in districts with high concentrations of students who couldn't pass the test. They would have been in every one of your districts, and the stories of why it was unfair to withhold a diploma would have been complex and often compelling. To cite just one example, many students would have pointed to having earned all of their required credits and having gotten years of passing and sometimes even good grades, only to find out when taking the 11th grade math test that they couldn't meet the requirements for graduation. They would have argued that when the system not only didn't include early warning signs of failure, but actually told them they were doing okay, it was unfair to hold them to the levels of performance expected on the grad. I hope you'll not forget these political realities that led the legislature and Governor Pawlenty to put the math grad reprieve in place as you approach these issues again in the current session. To ignore those factors would almost certainly mean that several years from now, you or your successors will need to issue another reprieve or revisit the policy yet again. And that's happened in state after state across the country, thereby squandering valuable time, attention, and resources that would be better spent on reforming and improving our schools and systems than on changing tests and cut scores. As is often said about standardized testing, weighing the pig doesn't fatten it. And of course, testing a kid doesn't teach him how to read or do linear equations. We need to put the assessment and accountability goalposts in place in Minnesota and then keep them there in the same place for a sustained period of time so that policymakers, educators, and the students themselves can focus relentlessly on raising student achievement. But let's leave politics aside for a moment, because that certainly isn't my business. Is granting a diploma based solely on a student's ability to hit a cut score on a standardized test an effective way of determining the student's readiness for college or a career? Does instituting a high-stakes high school exit exam policy raise student achievement overall? If the answer to those questions is a clear yes, we should probably ignore the political outcry and implement the policy in the long-term interest of our students and our state. In fact, the research on the effectiveness of high-stakes exit examination policies is mixed at best, which I believe is not reason to abandon them, but to proceed with caution. A growing number of studies suggest that, like any standardized test, high-stakes exit exams are imperfect predictors of what students really know and can do. To give you just one example of that, the ACT and SAT college entrance exams have been shown to be decent predictors of how a student will perform in the first year of college, but poor predictors of how the student will do over the course of an entire college career and whether or not he or she will graduate on time or at all. While the next generation of standardized tests is expected to do a much better job of measuring students' understanding of higher order concepts and ability to apply academic knowledge to real world situations, those tests are very different from the primarily multiple choice tests that are and will continue to be used in Minnesota in the years immediately ahead. Moreover, other research, most of it conducted by economists rather than scholars of education, is finding that high-stakes exit policies negatively impact a small group of struggling students who don't earn diplomas because of them, but do not, as of yet, seem to have corresponding overall effects on the student who passed them. In other words, a small group who might otherwise have slid by and graduated without the necessary scarce skills does get caught, but there's no apparent overall gain into the entire state in student achievement. This may be because setting the bar on exit exams high enough to push students in the middle or the top of the academic distribution to work harder would mean denying high school diplomas to a large number of those students. And if denying diplomas to low-achieving students is politically difficult, denying them to middle-achieving students has thus far proven them to be politically impossible across the U.S. So by now you may be thinking that I'm really making a case for the state to have no test-based requirements for graduation. And I appreciate, Madam Chair and members, you allowing me to go into that point at length, because my intent is, as I mentioned, to argue for conservatism and caution in putting in place these policies, in particular thinking of the individual students they'll impact. What we need is a high school assessment and accountability system that incentivizes and holds our students and our schools accountable for achieving what really matters for college and career success, and that minimizes the unintended consequences that unfairly harm some students, but does not improve the overall system. Madam Chair and members, I will not go into the points of convergence between these two bills, and there are many, and they're exciting and positive. They focus on the same subject areas. They have a shared focus on end-of-course tests. They focus on creating alternative routes. They focus on creating an appeals process for students who can legitimately show that they know the content but can't demonstrate it on a standardized test. So let me jump to and conclude with the real issue here, the question of stakes. On the access system, the approach we took to stakes was this. On the 10th grade language arts exam, there was a cut score. Students would be required to perform at or above a cut score below which we are statistically as certain as possible that the student does not possess the literacy skills needed to succeed in post-secondary education in the workplace. The proposal's use of a single cut score in language arts to determine a student's eligibility to earn a diploma is reflective of the fact that there are simply certain reading and writing skills that are necessary to succeed in any career, and frankly, just to function in an information age society. In contrast, however, there's much more debate and greater variance in what students need for post-secondary and career success in mathematics and biology. When was the last time any of us, for example, needed to use a logarithm or map out the process of mitosis? That is not to say it's not important for students to study those subjects, but we should be careful about how we require them to demonstrate mastery of those subjects to earn a general high school diploma. Do we really want to deny that diploma for a student's inability to correctly answer a sufficient number of questions on a standardized test about content that he or she may use only briefly after high school, if at all? If so, that's a very high-stakes decision in a society where without a high school diploma, it is all but impossible to secure a job with wages that can support a family. The access system, Madam Chair, attempts to deal with that proposal by making the student score on the test 25% of the student's score in the final course grade, which is already required for graduation in Minnesota in biology and algebra. And so the student's performance in the test would be a major factor in his or her ability to graduate from high school. The logic of that proposal was that it moved Minnesota toward using multiple measures of student achievement, the standardized test, but also assignments, projects, labs, and other requirements in order to determine eligibility for high school. But let me conclude, Madam Chair, with a final thought that may begin, I hope, to point us toward some resolution of the issues that a number of my colleagues and I debated last spring. All the members of the task force were able to endorse the report, with the exception of my friend you're about to hear from in a moment, Jim Bartholomew, who represented the Minnesota Business Partnership on our task force and is testifying today as well. Jim will, of course, describe his own views on these subjects, but I know that he and his organization supported many aspects of the access proposal, but were very concerned about the absence of a cut score on that algebra test, below which students would not be able to graduate from high school. The concern significantly was that a student could bomb the test and still earn a diploma. Others across the state that weren't on our task force shared that concern as well. As I've thought back on the access discussions we had last spring, I've regretted that we were unable to find a compromise on this question despite agreement on so many other aspects of the new system. In the interest of one more effort to reach such a compromise, I'd like to suggest that we collectively consider a modification to the legislation before you today that reflects some of the concerns of both sides while hopefully preserving the integrity of the proposal as a whole. In proposing this compromise today, I should be clear that I'm not reflecting the opinions of any of the Access Working Group members, nor my co-chair, Dr. Mattson, or even the author of this legislation. And that proposal is simply this. While I don't advocate adding a cut score to the end-of-course exam in biology, because we have much less evidence that mastery of that subject is essential for all students in college and careers, I do believe that we should see if we can find a way to set a cut score in mathematics that both the education and business communities can embrace. I believe that might be possible if we clarify that the end of course exam in mathematics should measure mastery of content that is traditionally defined as Algebra 1. And on that Algebra 1 exam, we would establish the cut score below which, as in language arts, we are statistically certain that a student is not ready after high school to succeed in entry-level credit-bearing mathematics courses at the majority of our state's four-year colleges and universities. For students who score above the minimum cut score on an end-of-course Algebra 1 test, their test score would still count as 25% of their final course grade. That would allow multiple measures to be factored into their eligibility to graduate. That's added accountability, Madam Chair and members, because some students who don't fail the state test will not perform sufficiently well on their class requirements and may not pass the course. The question of whether we should set the bar at Algebra 1 or Algebra 2 occupied hours of our working group's discussions last spring and was so hard to resolve that we ended up using the general term high school algebra, which is also the term used in our state standards, in our final report. There were two big issues that caused great hesitance in making a cut score on an Algebra 2 exam the standard for earning a high school diploma. The first of those issues is the fact that requiring all students just to take Algebra 2 is a quantum leap in our expectations for mathematics mastery in the United States. When you enter the realm of Algebra 2, you're talking about quadratics, logarithms, imaginary numbers, and other abstract applications of mathematics. That is a quantum leap, as I've noted, in our expectations for students in mathematics. For example, to get as one piece of evidence of how much of a paradigm shift that is, the national organization ACHIEVE has created a very high quality and very challenging Algebra 2 exam that has been administered in a group of states over the past 2 years, including high achieving states such as Massachusetts and a small sample of students here in Minnesota. In 2009, 13 states gave the test, and 14.6% of students scored in the prepared and well-prepared ranges. In 2010, 9 states gave the test, and 13.3% of students scored in those ranges. While raising achievement in algebra to much higher levels must be our longer-term goal, should we use that content to establish minimum proficiency requirements for earning a high school diploma in Minnesota today? A final issue, Madam Chair, on this subject that our Access Working Group had to grapple with in setting the bar in mathematics was evidence shared by one of the members of our group, Dr. Larry Gray, a highly regarded mathematician and former chair of the mathematics department at the University of Minnesota. Larry argued repeatedly and, for me, persuasively that if a high school student truly masters Algebra 1, he or she is ready for a credit-bearing course in college algebra at our institution and many others. Notably, Larry also stressed that if a student masters Algebra 1 early in his or her high school career, that doesn't mean he or she can stop taking mathematics, but must continue throughout high school. Madam Chair, I know I've thrown an additional idea into the mix here that is not directly related to Bill, related to the legislation before you, but frankly, it seemed to me as I revisited this issue in recent days that this might be an approach that could point a way forward. And by way of concluding, I would note, Madam Chair, that here at the Capitol and elsewhere in Minnesota, many of you have been interested of late in the strategy that Florida has used to raise student achievement overall and to close achievement gaps between student groups. Notably, Florida is moving to an end-of-course exam in Algebra 1, on which students there will be a cut score that holds students accountable for performance. So in sum, I support this legislation as it is written strongly, but in order potentially to move us toward consensus, I would urge you to consider modifications in the area of mathematics along these lines to see if we can actually agree on a road forward. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I'll start out by thanking Senator Nenow for carrying this legislation, as well as thanks again to Dr. Mattson and Mr. Pickell for their chairing the Access Committee. It was an honor to serve, and we did have some differences. And I think I'll just mention at the beginning, while it was an honor to serve on that committee, and there were fabulous people there, other than Senator Wieger, Representative Mariani, I was the only other non-educator on that panel. So, again, I'm not saying anything negative about that, other than it lacked a certain amount of diversity of background and opinion. And perhaps that's why we were the only ones that dissented with the recommendations. We support Senate File 605 because it will help ensure that a high school graduate who's earned a diploma has a basic level of competency in reading, writing, math, and biology. And again, the grad, math grad, and the replacement system moving to the end of course exams are built and aligned on Minnesota's state standards. Just FYI, it's my understanding the math grad, the cut score for that is set at just below an 11th grade level. In the replacement system, kids would get reading and writing at a 10th grade level. Biology is typically given in the 9th grade. And as Mr. Pickell mentioned, that would be high school math, so probably 10th, 11th grade typically. And Senate File 605 is asking is that students be able to pass at a grade level performance. So 10th grade reading and writing, 9th grade biology, middle high school and math. Why is this important? And Senator Nelson's bill before this was excellent. You covered a lot of, as you heard, 70% of all new jobs. Today's fifth graders, when they graduate from high school, 70% of all jobs are going to require completion of some higher ed. Where are we now? For the class of 2011, only 27% are expected to either complete a two-year degree within 3 years or a four-year degree within 6 years of graduation. So when today's fifth graders graduate, 70% are going to need some higher ed. Today, for the class of 2011, only 27% are going to get on time, if you would, a two- or a four-year degree. So we have a bit of a gap. You also heard about the cost of remediation. And again, you've heard from both Minsky and the U that about 40% of today's high school graduates who within 2 years go into Minsky or the U need remedial services. And the testimony was that was about $90 million a year, roughly half of that from students. The key difference, as has been brought up, is the math grad moving that up, having a passing requirement for the algebra and the biology end of course assessments. And then I'm not sure really that the alignment index was brought up for much conversation, but there was an alignment index proposed in Senator Wieger's bill to make sure we didn't have grade inflation. If you have 25% based on the test and 75% based on everything else, a number of states have found that for whatever reason, that other 75% gets inflated to compensate for the 25% of the test results. So there was a proposal to create an alignment index to try to keep an eye on that. And again, most of the task force recommendations were fine and we support, and there is a lot of commonality. But just frankly, we believe students should actually be able to pass an objective grade level assessment in reading, writing, math, and biology to receive a diploma. And just a couple responses, if you will. The idea that we're waiting until a high school student takes an assessment to find out if there's a warning flag that something might be wrong, that they're not prepared, these assessments are aligned with our state standards, which means they're aligned with our MCAs in grades 3 through 8. And anybody who's received a MCA report from, frankly, the department, but shows how their kid is doing on the MCAs, you'll know if there's a red flag or not. That shows your student, your child, every year, how they're doing in reading and writing on the MCAs. And if they're falling behind, there's your red flag. Same for the teachers in the schools that the students are attending. Don't push the kids along. There will be a train wreck in high school. We need to get them early. And this committee's had a lot of good conversation, in particular, about literacy. And what do you do about making sure kids read by grade level? Another comment was the need for consistent.
If I might just interject there, because the thought occurs to me that the learning that we, what we learned in the process, is that you can't learn if you haven't been taught, and if you haven't been taught in ways in which your mind functions, in ways in which you can learn. And I think that, you know, we've done a lot on that level in terms of being able to get that reading proficiency. Maybe this is an area where we're not looking necessarily in the right place as to why is it that our students are not able to get these fundamentals of math along the way. Can we look at some of the processes and the teaching methods and things that will address the spectrum of students so that they, in fact, can achieve proficiency? So I know that we've got a committee that's going to be breathing down our necks to get into this room. So let's wrap up. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just cannot cannot restrain myself in this count. We've got to get to the bottom of it, yeah. And so that we have kids performing, because we can't deal, as has been laid out, we can't deal with all these kids failing, because it isn't necessary. They can, in fact, learn. We know it. And we've got to find the way to do it right. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, we could not agree with you more. And the performance numbers in OSEEK, we know how kids are doing on the MCAs in reading and math. There really are no secrets. And really, to cut to the chase, the question is, do we want to allow kids to graduate with a diploma knowing that they aren't adequately prepared, and then need remediation, or go to try and find a job and find out they don't have the preparation? Is that a more adequate response, just let them go? Or try to keep them within our K-12 system, where we can provide publicly funded services to help them get them up to speed so they know what they need to know to that next level? We just no longer, members, can afford in any respect to pass kids along. And I'll take questions. It's a topic of a lot of conversation, and I think Mr. Pickell is correct when he says that this is, if not the one of the most important conversations you have, is what does that high school diploma mean? Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions that you might have before I toss out a math problem for you?
Not the test.
Madam Chair, this will be quick, but Mr. Bartholomew, what did you think of Dr. Pickell's compromise proposal?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I heard about it at the same time you did.
Okay.
So I'd like to learn a little more.
Thank you.
Had an opportunity to hear a college president that's quite renowned, who is math is his specialty, and he just gets goosebumps when he thinks about math. And he laid a challenge on us without giving us the answer. And I'm going to give it to you. It's a class of 29 students, and 20 of them have dogs, and 15 of them have cats. How many have both? So with that, I will just leave that with that challenge with you, and we'll see what. I hope I don't let it keep you awake tonight, though. So, thank you very much. We are going to lay these bills on the table, because obviously we're not going to just pick and choose here. There is some work, and it's as you said, it's in the in the conference committee. So hopefully we will be able to continue to work on this. And I appreciate members sharing their thoughts as we're going to be hearing to the next couple of days. We may have some time for further discussion as well. So thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Okay, so good luck in your place. Enjoy.